leaves you as the perfect meal to break his fast and feed his cub, rich in protein, calories, and omega-3s, and begins hurling toward you at full speed. At this moment, your amygdala, which is essentially your brain's lookout deck, kicks your sympathetic nervous response into motion, priming your body for action. The amygdala activates something called the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal, or HPA, axis, causing the adrenal glands to secrete cortisol and epinephrine, also known as adrenaline, and suddenly your mellow day of flower picking becomes an all-out sprint for your life. The HPA axis, the stress response switchboard. Once initiated, the HPA axis begins in the brain structure known as the hypothalamus, the H in HPA. One of the most important functions of the hypothalamus, aside from its role as a metabolic master controller, is to link the brain to the body's hormone system via the pituitary gland. The hypothalamus sends out some corticotropin-releasing hormone, or CRH, to the pituitary gland, the meat in the HPA sandwich. After receiving word of turmoil from the hypothalamus, the pituitary gland then secretes something called adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH, into circulation. Recall that hormones are long-range messengers which differ from neurotransmitters which act neuron to neuron. Now in circulation, ACTH acts on the adrenal glands which are perched above the kidneys. This causes a surge in cortisol and epinephrine. The cortisol and adrenaline that are now coursing through your body have several effects on your physiology. For one, heart rate and blood pressure go way up. Pupils dilate. Salivary secretion halts and digestion slows. Digestion is a relatively labor-intensive process, and running from Mufasa is no time to be using precious resources on nutrient absorption. In fact, blood leaves the digestive area, rerouting to more important locations like your muscles. Blood sugar is released from the liver, and the parts of your body that are inessential to getting you out of harm's way become resistant to insulin, making sure that your muscles can get all the glucose that they need. The immune system becomes suppressed and blood itself becomes more viscous as platelets, the type of blood cells involved in clotting, begin to aggregate as a cautionary measure in case of blood loss. The odds of being chased by a lion are pretty slim these days. If you're lucky, true threats of a physical nature aren't a common occurrence, but while our sources of stress have evolved, our response to them has not. So when you have an argument with a coworker, run to catch your subway only to be left on the platform as it screeches away, or get frightened by the air horn of an 18-wheeler as it lurches alongside you in traffic, the same domino effect begins in your body. When you have multiple stressful stimuli back to back, your body's response can create serious problems. This is why stress is such a vicious, indiscriminate killer. The chronic activation of this antiquated system, once life-saving, now promotes inflammation, elevated blood sugar, insulin resistance, nutrient deficiencies, increased gut permeability, and more. But chronic stress plus carbs? That's a recipe for disaster. At this point, it may not surprise you to know that as our waists grow, our brains shrink. We've already covered many factors that might explain this startling observation, except one, chronically elevated cortisol due to stress. Ever see a person with a bulging midsection but surprisingly skinny arms and legs? This is the picture of chronic stress. It's completely different from your run-of-the-mill obesity where everything, legs, arms, butt, is blown up to comparable proportions. This is because deep abdominal fat, the kind that wraps itself around your heart, liver, and other major organs, not only receives more blood but has four times more cortisol receptors than subcutaneous fat. The fat that you can pinch below the skin. When cortisol is elevated, any carbohydrate intake will immediately promote fat storage, and most likely as the deep abdominal fat called visceral fat, which is the most dangerous and inflammatory kind of fat. This makes concentrated carbohydrate consumption uniquely damaging to a stressed out person. This is another reason why eating carbs first thing in the morning when cortisol is naturally at its peak is a bad idea. If you're experiencing a bout of stress, the reaction should be twofold. First, deal with that stress. And second, keep concentrated sources of glucose and fructose especially low. Here are some other important stress-abating tips. Meditate, don't medicate. Meditation can be intimidating for first-timers, but it's worth getting comfortable with. One small Thai study of stressed-out medical students found that 4 days of meditation reduced cortisol by 20%. Spend more time outdoors. We've lost touch with nature, but merely seeing greenery mitigates the physiological response to stress and improves cognitive function. Being in nature can also help reduce depressive thoughts and even boost BDNF. Exercise smarter. Alternate between low and slow aerobic sessions, a bike ride or a hike in nature, and more intense bursts. Chronic medium-intensity cardio sessions, running on a treadmill for 45 minutes, for example, can actually increase cortisol. We'll see more on this in Chapter 10. Have somebody give you a massage, or pay for one. Never a bad investment. A 2010 study out of Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles found that 5 weeks of Swedish massage significantly reduced serum cortisol compared to controls who underwent only light touching. Practice deep breathing. Simple, yet effective. Exhaling activates the parasympathetic nervous system responsible for the body's rest and digest processes. It's been known for some time that a chronic elevation of cortisol compromises the brain's supply of BDNF and can atrophy vulnerable structures like the hippocampus, even causing dendrites, the physical correlates of memories, to recede. This reinforces the negative aspects of stress, since the hippocampus normally vetoes inappropriate stress responses. Repeated stress therefore hurts your ability to control stress, and this has been borne out in the research. In mice that were subjected to chronic social defeat, the equivalent of having a bully in the cage with them, their memories suffer significantly. If the neural pathways created by learning are akin to an ever-expanding set of train tracks, it seemed as if those mice under duress were having trouble laying down new tracks. Recent research has also highlighted new mechanisms by which chronic stress can impair your long-term brain health. Chronic stress was shown to actually activate the immune system of the brain, producing inflammation almost as if the brain were responding to stress as an infection. Inflammation is the cornerstone of many neurodegenerative diseases, as I've mentioned throughout this book, but recently chronic exposure to stress hormones was connected to the hallmark plaque that characterizes Alzheimer's disease. Long-term administration of cortisol was shown to reduce levels of insulin-degrading enzyme, or IDE, in the brains of monkeys. IDE is responsible for breaking down insulin in the brain as well as amyloid beta, the protein that clumps together to form the plaques characteristic of Alzheimer's disease. Revisit Chapter 4 for a primer on IDE. As you can see, chronic stress is a major threat to our cognitive health. But not all stress is created equal. In the following chapter, we will see how one particular kind of stress may be your brain's best friend. Field notes. Sleep is sacred. It keeps your hormones healthy, helps your brain better regulate your emotions, and can even help you lose weight. Sleep is also when your brain cleans itself, offering a free power wash every night thanks to the newly discovered glymphatic system. We can optimize sleep and the glymphatic system with a high-fiber, low-carbohydrate diet. Fasting can dramatically increase growth hormone, which protects lean mass. For a fat-adapted, low-carb dieter, the occasional high-carb, low-fat cheat day can help to increase leptin levels, which will encourage fat burning and enhance mood. Stress management is paramount to health. Chronic stress grows our waists, shrinks our brains, and creates performance-zapping inflammation. Genius food number 9, wild salmon. The consumption of wild fish has long been associated with reduced risk for cardiovascular disease, cancer, and even all-cause mortality. But what about its impact on the brain? I'm glad you asked, because consumers of wild fish exhibit superior cognitive aging and better memory function, and even possess bigger brains. In a recent study, cognitively normal older people who ate seafood, including fish, shrimp, crab, or lobster, more than once per week, had reduced decline of verbal memory and slower rates of decline in a test of perceptual speed over 5 years compared to people who ate less than one serving per week. The protective association of seafood was even stronger among individuals with the common Alzheimer's risk gene, APOE4. The king of these fishes is wild salmon, which is low in mercury and a rich source of both EPA and DHA omega-3 fats, and a powerful carotenoid called astaxanthin. Derived from krill, the main food supply of wild salmon, this carotenoid is added into the diets of farm-raised salmon to give the characteristic pink to their color. But it's far more abundant in salmon that is wild, hence the richer color. Astaxanthin is beneficial to your entire body and can help do the following. Boost cognitive function and promote neurogenesis. Protect the skin from sun damage and enhance skin appearance. Protect the eyes, reducing inflammation. Convert blood lipids to a more cardioprotective profile. Provide potent antioxidant effects and free radical scavenging. Some of these benefits appear to be facilitated by astaxanthin's unique molecular structure, which allows it to shield cell membranes from oxidative stress. On top of that, it has also been shown to switch on genes that protect against DNA damage and the stresses of aging, such as the FOXO3 longevity pathway described in Chapter 4. Shrimp, crab, and lobster are also high in astaxanthin and are good options when you're looking for a little variety in your wild fish consumption. How to use: broil, pan-sear, poach, or eat raw if sashimi grade. Pro tip: all types of fatty fish, including sardines, herring, mackerel, and anchovies are good alternatives. I will often travel with canned sardines to serve as a quick snack or to add to a meal, and I've included them in my Better Brain Bowl. See the PDF enhancement. Just make sure any canned fish is packed in olive oil, ideally extra virgin, or water only. Chapter 10: The Virtues of Stress, or How to Become a More Robust Organism. Consider that Mother Nature is not just safe. It is aggressive in destroying and replacing, in selecting and reshuffling. When it comes to random events, robust is certainly not good enough. In the long run, everything with the most minute vulnerability breaks, given the ruthlessness of time. Yet our planet has been around for perhaps 4 billion years, and, convincingly, robustness can't just be it. You need perfect robustness for a crack not to end up crashing the system. Given the unattainability of perfect robustness, we need a mechanism by which the system regenerates itself continuously by using, rather than suffering from, random events, unpredictable shocks, stressors, and volatility. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, Anti-Fragile: Things That Gain from Disorder. In fewer words, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. Friedrich Nietzsche. Finding stagnation in the universe is a difficult task. It simply doesn't exist. Celestial bodies are either being slowly created or slowly destroyed. Here on Earth, stagnation is associated with rot and decay, like a pond that has lost its inflow. For our brains, it is a death sentence. Like all matter in the universe, we are subject to the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. This fundamental law of physics states that all systems, over time, decline from states of higher complexity to lower complexity. This slow transition from order to disorder is what occurs to stars, planets, and entire galaxies, and is also what happens to us during the aging process. At first, however, human life seems to defy this law, in the profound regenerative abilities that a child exhibits. Children don't often develop cardiovascular disease. Stop the presses, signs of it are creeping up in children as young as 8 due to the ravages of the standard American diet. They don't get dementia, and almost 90% of pediatric cancer cases are curable. These superhuman abilities are seemingly lost during our elder years. What if we could turn back time and regain the level of resilience we've all exhibited in youth, to rage against the dying of the light, so to speak? I'm here to tell you that it may be possible, in a form that has for a long time been demonized in mainstream and medical literature alike. Stress, the antidote to stagnation. Now, before you throw your hands up in confusion, let me clarify. There are two kinds of stress. There is chronic stress, the kind that comes from a bad job, sour relationship, prolonged financial hardship, or even what my friend, fitness author, and mega athlete Mark Sisson calls chronic cardio, discussed momentarily. This kind of stress accelerates entropy and decay. It leads to prolonged elevation of the hormone cortisol, which can rob our muscles of strength and redistribute our body fat to our bellies, cause important parts of the brain to atrophy, and even accelerate the aging process. Acute or temporary stress is a different beast entirely, and may be one of our most powerful weapons in the fight against entropy. This form of stress may take many shapes. It may be the mental stress that one endures when learning to play an instrument, engaging in a particularly challenging and lifelike video game, or sitting through a tough lecture. It can also be physical stress in the form of exercise, brief bouts of fasting, extreme temperatures, or even certain types of stressful foods. Hormesis, one of my favorite biological principles, is the mechanism by which small doses of stress from, say, a tough workout, a good sweat in a sauna, or even temporary calorie restriction, which we call intermittent fasting, can promote more efficient cells and greater long-term health. While large doses of a particular stressor might harm you, small doses actually cause your cells to adapt and grow stronger. The following pages will explore how you can leverage the power of hormesis to supercharge your cognition and help you live stronger for longer. Movement. Now here you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that. The Red Queen, Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. I've always been terrible at sports. The few summers my parents were brave enough to send me off to camp, I abstained from playing games like football, soccer, and dodgeball and gravitated to archery, rocketry, and ceramics instead. When it came time for swimming, I was always too shy to take off my shirt, an insecurity that I've thankfully outgrown. In high school, rather than join the basketball team like many of my peers, I was drawn to computer programming. I became interested in the gym only when I learned exercise could manifest as a stronger or leaner body. I began to see both food and exercise as code to speak to my biological programming. In retrospect, I realized that many of the same feedback loops that drew me to programming were also present in fitness, including the ability to simplify my routine and debug problems. These feedback loops provided enough dopamine hits to hook a shy and introverted 16-year-old computer programmer, and the increased attention from my female classmates wasn't bad either. That exercise is one of the greatest known means of enhancing cognitive function, mood, and neuroplasticity really shouldn't come as a surprise. When it all boils down, we're a species made to move, and yet, along with our diets, our lifestyles have undergone a dramatic shift. We used to roam thousands of miles on foot as hunter-gatherers, and when we weren't walking or hiking, we were running, not sitting at desks, on trains, or in cars stuck in traffic. Just how adapted to movement are we? Recently analyzed fossils of Aboriginal footprints show a stride indicating that our ancestors were, on average, at least as fast as Usain Bolt, the Olympic sprinting champion. Other signs are evident in our bodies. We're excellent at dissipating heat through sweat, we have long legs, large knees, and the spring-like Achilles tendon, which, despite its name, is one of the strongest soft structures in the animal kingdom. And with relatively voluminous backsides and a large percentage of fatigue-resistant, slow-twitch muscle fibers, we may also be the endurance athletes of said kingdom. Today, however, we grab our lunches to go so that we can sit and eat in isolation at our desks. We're mostly stationary throughout our workday and during our commute, and then we sit on the couch and binge-watch hours of television. Research over the past few years has validated the notion that chronic sitting is bad for us. So bad, in fact, that some experts have even gone so far as to call sitting the new smoking. While this may sound hyperbolic, excessive sitting has been linked to early mortality, representing nearly 4% of annual deaths worldwide. This association shrinks dramatically with the addition of even just a little bit of extra movement in the day. One study from the University of Utah found that just 2 minutes of walking for every hour spent sitting dramatically reduced by 33% risk of early death, while a study out of the University of Cambridge found that an hour of moderate intensity exercise a day eliminated it completely. For the brain, exercise might as well be considered a panacea, continually validated by research trials in both the cognitively healthy and impaired. It acts as both medicine and a tonic, coating our vulnerable organ in a chemical cocktail of smart molecules ranging from powerful antioxidants to nerve growth factors. And after listening to this section, you'll know exactly how to implement exercise for maximum cognitive gain. The brain grower. Okay, so you're sold on exercise. Where do we start? There are two main energy systems that you can train, aerobic and anaerobic. For simplicity's sake, aerobic exercise is akin to a long bike ride or hike, while anaerobic exercise tends to include weightlifting or sprinting. Think of the former as fat and oxygen burning, and the latter as sugar burning. Aerobic training gets your heart rate up and can be sustained for a long period of time. The vast majority of the day, you're functioning in a state of aerobic respiration. Aerobic exercise simply increases the intensity and demand on your metabolism, but under similar metabolic conditions. Aerobic exercise, low and slow. Hiking, bike ride, long brisk walk, light yoga. All forms of exercise help to increase blood flow to the brain, pushing desperately needed oxygen and nutrients to our biological control centers. But aerobic exercise in particular has been found to be one of the best known means of boosting brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. I've used phrases like miracle grow for the brain and the brain's ultimate fertilizer throughout this book to convey the powerful effect BDNF has in terms of promoting neuroplasticity and protecting your brain cells. But I admit these may still seem like abstract concepts. Sadly, we can't flex our hippocampi in the mirror. If you had access to an MRI machine, however, you'd be able to see the profound growth that BDNF promotes. A seminal study published in 2011 gave scientists the opportunity to do just this. It involved 120 cognitively healthy adult subjects, half of whom regularly performed an aerobic exercise routine 3 times per week over the course of 1 year. Using an MRI, scientists saw that aerobic exercise increased the size of participants' hippocampi by 2% over what it was at the beginning of the study. Now, before you scoff at what may seem like a very modest increase, you should know that the hippocampus typically loses volume at a rate of about 1 to 2% each year after the 5th decade of life. And in fact, this happened in the control group. Their scans showed that the same degree of brain volume was actually lost. As noted by the researchers, aerobic exercise essentially turned back the clock on the hippocampus, the brain's memory formation center, by 1 to 2 years. At the time of this recording, there's no drug in the known universe that wields this degree of power. If that weren't exciting enough, the leap in size seen in the brains of the exercising group coincided with a performance boost in the type of memory used to navigate familiar places. Clothe your brain in Clotho. Clotho is a longevity protein named after Clotho, the fate from Greek mythology who's known for spinning the thread of life. Were Clotho real, she might be pleased to know of her affiliation with this aging suppressor, tasked with, among other things, making tighter, better connections at the synapse, the microscopic junctions where all neural processes occur. Independent of its effect on healthy brain aging, Clotho has a marked effect on cognition. About 1 in 5 lucky people have gene variants that cause them to create more of this protein, and a recent study found that those who had this gene tested on average 6 points higher on a test of broad cognitive domains, including language, executive function, visual and spatial intelligence, and learning and memory. While you may be tempted to exclaim, "See, it's all in your genes," the good news is that Clotho can be boosted with aerobic exercise. What's more, Clotho expression, like BDNF, is thought to be dependent on fitness level. So the more exercise you perform and the fitter you become, the more just a single bout of exercise will raise levels of Clotho. But beefing up your hippocampus doesn't just protect you from aging. While the hippocampus is one of the first parts of the brain to be attacked in Alzheimer's disease, it is also highly vulnerable to the insults of chronic stress. Chronically elevated cortisol, a consequence of the body's fight or flight system being overstimulated, can damage the hippocampus. This creates a negative feedback loop, as it is the hippocampus that largely dictates how calmly, or frantically, the brain will respond to a given event. This is because regions of the brain involved in fear and emotion consult with the hippocampus to determine how best to respond. As research has shown, by reinforcing this memory structure with exercise, we powerfully augment our brains to become more resilient to psychological stress. Exercise, the dementia slayer? One gene in particular, the APOE4 allele, continues to come up throughout this book. While far from a sentence to develop dementia, it is the only well-defined Alzheimer's risk gene, and having 1 or 2 copies does increase the likelihood that a person will develop cognitive decline. Research suggests that exercise can negate some of the gene's observed influences on the brain. It does so in part by normalizing brain glucose metabolism, which is reduced in APOE4 carriers, discussed in Chapter 6, and by reducing plaque buildup, which seems to be accelerated in carriers. Interestingly, the APOE4 allele is considered the ancestral, i.e. oldest, variant of the APOE gene, having emerged at a time when we had to chase our food. Its negative association with modern disease may be merely a consequence of our recent transition to relative inactivity, amplified by our industrially mangled diets. If neurological decline is one consequence of inactivity, might becoming more active actually reverse cognitive impairment? Researchers sought to answer this question in a 2013 study, ultimately finding that sedentary people with mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, improved their memory and the efficiency of their brain cells after just 3 months of regular exercise. The study also included a group of cognitively normal people who saw similar benefits. What's more, the subjects improved their cardiorespiratory fitness by just 10%, suggesting big cognitive gains for a relatively small boost in fitness. A follow-up study published in 2015 found that for both healthy older people and patients with MCI, exercise increased the size of the cortex, the outer layer of the brain that shrinks dramatically in late-stage Alzheimer's disease. In a very simplistic metaphor, the cortex can be considered the brain's hard drive, where memories are stored after being input by the hippocampus, the brain's keyboard. Participants who showed the greatest improvements in their fitness had the most growth in the cortical layer. Studies like this are key because MCI is considered a critical stage of cognitive decline that can lead to Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia. The metabolic enhancer. No man has the right to be an amateur in the matter of physical training. It is a shame for a man to grow old without seeing the beauty and strength of which his body is capable. Socrates, circa 400 BC. While aerobic activity is the chief way to fortify the brain with new brain cells, anaerobic exercise is the best way to keep those cells healthy and metabolically efficient. Unlike aerobic exercise, which can potentially be sustained for hours, particularly low to moderate intensity varieties, anaerobic modes of metabolism are experienced in bursts, achieved through physical activity that is performed at a much higher intensity and therefore impossible to sustain. This may include sprinting at near maximal effort for 10 to 20 or even 30 seconds, taking a break and repeating the process. Resistance training, weightlifting for example, is also anaerobic. While everybody's anaerobic threshold will be different, the principle is the same. By momentarily overloading your body, you provide a powerful stimulus for your cells to adapt, grow stronger, and become more efficient. Anaerobic exercise, hard and fast. All types of burst exercise, such as sprints, vigorous biking, rowing, battle ropes, weightlifting, steep hill climbing, interval training, isometrics, intense yoga. One visible benefit of anaerobic exercise is that over time your muscles grow. This is particularly beneficial for weight maintenance. While anaerobic exercise itself burns far fewer calories than aerobic exercise, the long run on a treadmill, for example, creating even just a little more muscle is beneficial for long-term weight loss. This is because the more muscle you have on your body, the higher work capacity you will have, the more high-intensity activity you can sustain, and the more calories you can soak up without storing them as body fat. Every time you hit the lactate threshold in your workouts, which is when your muscles start burning and trembling as you approach failure, you are emptying the stored carbs in the muscle and turning your body into an energy sponge. This means that when you consume a starch like rice or a sweet potato, the carbs become more likely to be shuttled into your muscle cells where they stay, waiting to power your next workout. And increasing muscle mass means more calories burned to fuel those muscles even when you're just waiting in line to check out at the supermarket. Pushing yourself to your physiological limits, however, confers benefits that extend far beyond bathing suit season. At the microscopic level, your mitochondria, the organelles that create cellular energy, feel the burden of increased demand. This is in part due to the surge in production of reactive oxygen species, or ROS, a normal byproduct of metabolism. You may also know of reactive oxygen species by another name, free radicals. Under normal circumstances, we want to keep these free radicals to a minimum, but in the case of exercise, their increase acts as a powerful signaling mechanism, setting off a cascade of events at the genetic and cellular levels meant to protect us and enhance our resilience to future stress. Doctor's note: obey your biological imperatives. Feeling the occasional bout of melancholy is a perfectly normal and probably even healthy aspect of the human condition. But if melancholia turns to negative self-talk, remember, don't judge your thought content or your mood unless you've been working out regularly. If you didn't walk your dog or let him out to play or run around every day, it would be considered animal abuse. And yet we seem to think it's okay to not move ourselves. Exercise should be the last thing to be abandoned when you're feeling busy or overwhelmed, not the first. When tested head-to-head against multiple antidepressants, 3 days a week of moderate exercise was determined to be equally effective as the pharmaceuticals, with the pleasant side effect of having zero side effects. Treat yourself at least as well as you do your puppy. You deserve it. One enzyme that becomes activated during anaerobic activity is called adenosine monophosphate activated protein kinase, or AMPK. Known as the metabolic master switch, AMPK acts like a tuning fork to your mitochondria, increasing fat burning and glucose uptake, and turning on waste disposal machinery to clear up cellular junk. This includes recycling old and damaged mitochondria. Activating AMPK is such a powerful means of enhancing cellular vigor that the diabetes drug metformin, which stimulates AMPK, is now being studied for its potential as a geroprotective or anti-aging agent. Preliminary research suggests it may improve symptoms in early Alzheimer's disease and help reduce one's risk for developing it. But you don't need drugs and their potential side effects to activate AMPK because short bursts of intense exercise do it as effectively. One of the most important ways that AMPK enhances your metabolism is by stimulating the creation of more mitochondria, a process called mitochondrial biogenesis. Having more mitochondria is generally considered a good thing, and we know this because chronic disuse of muscle, sedentary behavior, and aging each independently result in a decline in mitochondrial content and function. By creating new mitochondria in our muscle, we improve fitness and metabolic health, including sensitivity to insulin. This is why stimulating AMPK with anaerobic exercise, like weight training and sprinting, is one of the best known means of reversing insulin resistance along with dietary change. Footnote: many obese and insulin resistant patients are told to focus their energy on doing more cardio to lose weight, which ignores what would be the more appropriate aim of gaining more muscle to reestablish insulin sensitivity. But AMPK doesn't just spur this dramatic increase in mitochondria in our muscle tissue, it also does this in our fat cells, a process called browning. Once believed to be present only in newborns, brown fat is mitochondria-rich fat tissue whose main purpose is to burn calories to warm us up when we get a little chilly, a process called thermogenesis. Mitochondrial biogenesis spurred by exercise was also shown to occur in brain cells in animal research. This has obvious implications not only with regard to fighting mental fatigue and cognitive aging, but also with respect to neurodegenerative diseases that involve mitochondrial dysfunction, including Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and ALS. This may be why a large King's College London twin study showed a strong link between leg strength, involving the largest muscles in your body, and brain volume, with decreased cognitive aging across 10 years. All this taken together is why anaerobic exercise is a vital part of the brain health and cognitive optimization equation. Arthur Weltman, who heads the Exercise Physiology Laboratory at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, perhaps said it best in an interview with the website Science News. In order for physiological systems to adapt, they need to be overloaded. Whether that means hitting the weight room and lifting heavy things, pushing yourself to your limits on a stationary bike for a few moments, rinse and repeat, or adding some all-out sprinting to your cardio routine, including anaerobic exercise in your routine is a major opportunity to optimize your cognitive function. High-dose antioxidants, a cellular crutch? The call to your cellular machinery to grow stronger is signaled by a temporary increase in free radical mediated stress brought on by exercise. Take this pressure away and exercise becomes less effective. This was made evident in a University of Valencia trial in which high doses of an antioxidant, vitamin C, were given to athletes just prior to training. Not only was their performance negatively affected as a result, but many of the aforementioned benefits of exercise, increasing antioxidant coverage and mitochondrial biogenesis, were blocked. Studies like this highlight a potential negative effect of high-dose vitamin supplementation, which can indiscriminately block the stimulus our bodies need to grow stronger. For this reason, I do not recommend excessive vitamin supplements. Instead, a wiser approach is to naturally stimulate the body's own far more potent antioxidant compounds with exercise and foods such as avocados, berries, kale, broccoli, and dark chocolate. Conveniently, all qualifying genius foods. How to get the most out of exercise. As you can see, both aerobic and anaerobic exercise provide unique benefits to the brain and body that extend well beyond calories burned. But how much effort do you need to put in for maximum benefit? Surprisingly, a lot less than you would expect. The latest research suggests our aerobic workouts should be longer and slower, while our anaerobic workouts should be shorter and more intense. What we want to definitely avoid is chronic cardio or sustained high-output training, such as a hard 45-minute run multiple times per week. There's a peak point where we stress the body enough to stimulate adaptation, but more is not necessarily better. For example, long-time marathon runners lose lean mass, drop their testosterone levels, develop increased intestinal permeability, and can even develop scarring of the cardiac muscle and electrical conduction system, leading to dangerous and life-threatening arrhythmias, not to mention the wear and tear on their joints from thousands of steps. So what's the sweet spot? Essentially, instead of a grinding 45-minute run with a grimace on your face the entire way, you're better off doing a 90 to 120-minute hike, smiling and conducting a conversation the whole way. The low, slow movement, like hiking, will also help move lymphatic fluid around your body, develop your capillary beds, and keep your joints healthy. Otherwise, short sprints at 90 to 95% of maximum effort have been shown to have the same improvements in cardiorespiratory fitness and endurance in 20% of the time compared to steady-state cardio. A proper exercise routine should bleed into one's overall lifestyle, including aerobic work such as long walks, hikes, and biking to and from work, and concentrated anaerobic exertion. This way you maximize neuroplasticity through BDNF with aerobic exercise while achieving the metabolism fortifying effects of anaerobic exercise. Frequently asked question. I'm a woman. Won't weightlifting make me bulky? I gain muscle really easily. Answer. Muscle is hard-earned and gains come over a period of years, not weeks. And if you're afraid of looking jacked, trust us. You don't get ripped by accident. Dr. Paul and I have both been trying to get jacked for the last 20 years. On top of that, most females simply don't have the hormonal profile to get huge without illicit substances. As long as you're gaining muscle and not overeating or gaining significant weight, your body composition will improve. Your waistline will shrink and your arms will, yes, shrink even though they are getting stronger. Regular weightlifting also gives you a buffer for any carbs that sneak in here and there. Just remember, strong is the new skinny. It's also possible to incorporate aspects of both forms of exercise in the same workout. For example, if you enjoy weight training but dislike running, you can add an aerobic aspect to your workout simply by shortening the amount of rest in between sets. Alternatively, you may choose to do anaerobic workouts on some days of the week and aerobic on others. Whatever you choose to do, stick with what you enjoy and make sure to vary levels of intensity. Also, taking 1 to 2 days off per week for rest ensures that you do not overtrain, which can have deleterious effects. A typical week might look something like this. On Monday, resistance training. Option A, squats, deadlifts, kettlebell swings, bench press, push-ups, dips, pull-ups, rows, lunges. Option B, push exercises. Bench press, incline press, overhead press, battle ropes. Tuesday, Yoga. Wednesday, a bicycle ride to and from work. Thursday, more resistance training. Option A, squats, deadlifts, kettlebell swings, bench press, push-ups, dips, pull-ups, rows, lunges. Option B, pull exercises, pull-ups, rows, curls, stiff-legged deadlifts, battle ropes. Friday, yoga. Saturday, sprints in the park. Sunday, a long hike or walk. Heat conditioning. If one culture can be credited for single-handedly bringing hyperthermic, i.e. heat conditioning, into the mainstream, it may very well be the Finnish. Sauna use is an integral part of daily life in Finland, where there is on average one sauna for every household. Some of these saunas are built in the unlikeliest of places, in an abandoned phone booth, on a boat, or in an immobilized airstream. Many of these are caught on film in the quirky documentary Steam of Life, chronicling this musty national pastime. Elsewhere in the world, though, saunas tend to be found in spas and higher quality gyms. While you may be inclined to write saunas off as mere recreation with a schwitz, science is beginning to validate their use as a powerful health-modulating activity. Recent research has shown, both mechanistically and observationally, that hyperthermic therapy gives your brain a potent workout and might play a powerful role in protecting it from aging. Heat shock proteins, a protein bodyguard. Sitting in a hot sauna imposes a certain kind of stress on your body called, wait for it, heat stress. The highly adaptable human body, forged in the climate of East Africa, knows that heat can kill you and as a result takes precautionary measures to protect itself. One such protective measure includes activating heat shock proteins, or HSPs. As their name implies, heat is the primary variable to get HSPs going, although these proteins are also activated by exercise and cold temperatures. HSPs act to guard other proteins by protecting them from misfolding, as the consequences of protein misfolding are widespread. The unique three-dimensional configurations of proteins help them to be recognized by various receptors, providing lock-and-key functionality that allows them to perform many important jobs around the body. Proteins that become disfigured via misfolding are not only less effective, they become strangers to the immune system, which could evoke an autoimmune response. The misfolding of proteins is also directly implicated in a few diseases that you may be familiar with: Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lewy body dementia. All of these are classified as proteopathic diseases, meaning that proteins become misfolded and clump together into plaques. In Alzheimer's, it's the amyloid beta protein, whereas the alpha-synuclein protein is involved in Parkinson's and Lewy body dementia. But these plaques form in everyone, not just patients diagnosed with dementia, and doing what we can to prevent the formation of these plaques is worthwhile, especially if it's as simple as sitting in a sauna. One study, published in 2016 in the journal Age and Aging, provided first-of-its-kind population-level evidence that regular sauna use may indeed help save our brains from decline. Involving more than 2,000 people who were followed over 20 years, the study showed that sauna use 4 to 7 times per week led to a 65% reduced risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or other dementia, even after controlling for other variables like type 2 diabetes, socioeconomic status, and cardiovascular risk factors. Brain-boosting BDNF. Who doesn't appreciate a free lunch now and then? While exercise is an incredible way to nourish your brain with BDNF, heat stress from post-workout sauna use, for example, may push BDNF beyond what is achieved by exercise alone. To explore the synergy between exercise and ambient temperature, University of Houston scientists studied the neural effect that occurred when mice ran in cold or hot temperatures, either 40 degrees Fahrenheit or 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit. In both settings, mice generated a greater number of neurons in the hippocampus, despite running much shorter distances than those in the control group that ran at room temperature. What this suggests is that performing brief periods of exercise in either cold or hot ambient temperature may accelerate the brain benefits of exercise, a potential win for both the efficiency junkies and those with limited mobility. Just check with your doctor before doing this, especially if you have a medical condition. Are you Myron, my myelin? Prolactin is a hormone with a wide array of roles that's present in both men and women, but it is perhaps best known for its role in initiating lactation in soon-to-be mothers. It may also have a very interesting influence on the brain. Prolactin has been shown to rebuild myelin, the protective sheath that insulates neurons and makes your brain work faster. Women who are pregnant experience a surge in prolactin, and those with MS, an autoimmune disease where myelin is attacked, commonly go into remission at this time. Not to worry, though, pregnancy is not the only way to boost prolactin. Hyperthermic conditioning has also been shown to boost prolactin dramatically. One study demonstrated that men who stayed in a sauna that was heated to 80 degrees Celsius or 176 degrees Fahrenheit experienced a tenfold increase in prolactin. In a separate study, women who were habitual sauna users who spent 20 minutes in a dry sauna had a 510% increase in prolactin immediately following the session. Can boosting prolactin with saunas be used to treat MS? Great caution should be exercised if the disease has already developed, as temperature-sensitive patients with MS have been shown to exhibit a temporary decline in cognitive function following a sauna. In terms of prevention, sauna use for MS is uncharted territory, but based on the above, its utility is certainly plausible. Are you suffering from chronic climate control? Primates and early humans experienced physiological stressors, including changes in temperature, for millions of years. Today, however, our lack of such thermal exercise may be to the detriment of our health and brain function. But how extreme do temperatures need to be to elicit a positive response from our bodies? Not very, it turns out. Exposure to even mild ambient cold induces something called non-shivering thermogenesis, which is when your body warms itself up to protect against heat loss. Your body does this by ramping up calorie burning in the power-generating mitochondria of brown fat. This is a type of fat that we actually want more of because it promotes better metabolic health. Brown fat is so keen on burning off calories that non-shivering thermogenesis can account for up to 40% of your metabolic rate, making it a powerful form of exercise you can do without even moving. In one shining example of the hormonal benefits of cold exposure, people with type 2 diabetes were told to endure 6 hour per day exposure to mild cold at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. After a mere 10 days, they improved their insulin sensitivity by a whopping 40%. You may recall from Chapter 4 that insulin sensitivity is highly correlated to better brain health and brain power. Other studies have suggested that thermogenesis, calorie burning in exchange for warmth, and metabolic benefits can occur at an even milder temperature, 66 degrees Fahrenheit. If the thought of being even remotely chilly makes you reach for the nearest blanket, take comfort. The more we expose ourselves to cooler temperatures, the more health benefits we stand to gain. And these benefits increase even as we mentally adapt to the cooler temperatures. So next time you're standing by your thermostat wondering what to program, keep in mind that chronic climate comfort may be in the same league as sugar when it comes to metabolic mayhem. Intermittent fasting. Intermittent fasting is quickly becoming known as one of the best ways to enhance your vitality and vigor. In Chapter 6, I discussed how intermittent fasting can stoke the ketogenic fire, your brain's preferred fuel, by reducing insulin. But as a hormetic stressor, fasting is also able to turn on many of the same repair genes that we've already discussed, increasing antioxidant coverage and BDNF production. It is thought that the body takes these periods of rest from food as an opportunity to clean house, recycle damaged proteins, and kill off immune cells that have become dysfunctional. In antiquity, fasting periods were baked into the cake, so to speak, because food was simply not in plentiful supply year-round. We'll be the first to admit that it's a lot easier to not eat when there's no food in sight than to build fasting periods into our busy lives, but as detailed below, we think it's well worth the extra effort. Whether by time-restricted feeding or periodic low-calorie diets, more on these below, the benefits of fasting are numerous. Improved decision-making. This makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint. What would happen to our survival chances if we got dumber the minute food wasn't around? Our species probably wouldn't have lasted very long. Improved insulin sensitivity. Fasting can improve markers of metabolic health, including our ability to effectively use glucose and fat as fuel. Enhanced fat loss. In the morning, cortisol is naturally elevated, allowing for the mobilization of stored fatty acids and sugars that our organs can use for fuel. By fasting, we enable cortisol to do what it does best. Activation of survival genes involved in antioxidant protection and repair. Intermittent fasting is one of the best ways to jumpstart the NRF2 pathway, a genetic master switch that increases antioxidant coverage. Activation of autophagy. Autophagy is the body's waste disposal system, whereby cellular junk, including damaged cells that could lead to cancer, get cleaned up. Much of this debris is pro-inflammatory, and stoking this cleanup process has been associated with dramatically longer lifespans and health spans in animals. Improved hormone profile. Fasting is one of the best ways to boost growth hormone, which is neuroprotective and helps preserve lean muscle tissue. Increased BDNF and neuroplasticity. Fasting is a potent BDNF booster which promotes neuroplasticity at any age. Neuroplasticity is the ability to grow new brain cells and preserve the ones you have. And it even helps to improve mood. Increased cholesterol recycling. Soon after beginning a fast, the breakdown of excess cholesterol into beneficial bile acids begins. Reduced inflammation and enhanced resistance to oxidative stress. Studies in humans during the month-long religious holiday Ramadan, which involves daily fasting, have shown that markers of inflammation are dramatically reduced during this period. Enhanced synaptic protection. New research suggests that fasting might help reduce synaptic activity by preventing excessive neurotransmitter release. The most popular intermittent fasting protocol is the 16-8 fast protocol, which is a time-restricted feeding diet. This would entail fasting for 16 hours while eating unrestrictedly during the 8 or 10-hour feeding window. This window can be adjusted to whichever hours work best for you, and women may get just as many benefits from a shorter fast. As previously discussed, women's hormone systems may be more sensitive to signals of food scarcity. This is just a theory, but women do seem to react differently than men to longer fasts. Footnote. While we surmise that there may be beneficial hormonal effects to keeping the feeding window later in the day rather than eating first thing in the morning, to allow cortisol to do its job of liberating stored fatty acids for use as fuel, you also want to ensure that you leave enough time to digest, 2 to 3 hours, before going to sleep. Eating immediately before bedtime can disrupt sleep as well as the brain's maintenance processes. Remember not to deprive yourself during the feeding window. This is when one would consume all of the healthy fats, protein, and fibrous veggies that the brain and body need each day. Malnourishment is definitely not the end goal. The goal is merely to regain the critical balance between anabolic, or storing, and catabolic, breaking down states. During the fasting window, you may drink as much water as you want along with tea or black coffee, neither of which contain any calories. Another protocol is alternate day fasting, a method studied by University of Illinois researcher Krista Verity. This involves a very small feeding window, between noon and 12 p.m., for example, every other day. This allows for one large meal during fasting days and unrestricted eating on feeding days. There are other protocols that are effective as well, such as back-to-back very low-calorie days, the fasting mimicking diet, termed by researcher Walter Longo. And for some people, a full 24-hour to 36-hour fast every couple of months may be just what it takes to feel a sense of biological spring cleaning. Though the intermittent fasting methods are different, the mechanisms are similar, and ultimately it comes down to personal preference. Don't be afraid to play around, and note that many find not eating for a few extra hours per day easier than trying to count calories, including the authors. Stressful foods. Sola dosis facit venenum. All things are poison, and nothing is without poison. Only the dose makes a thing not a poison. Paracelsus. Stressful foods? I know, that doesn't sound very pleasant. But many of the most valuable foods you already eat every single day confer their benefits by being stressful at the cellular level. Like any organism, plants don't want to be eaten. They're at a bit of a disadvantage, however, as they can't run from predators or fight them off with teeth or weapons. Instead, they turn to chemistry to defend themselves against threats by developing compounds that are toxic to insects, fungi, and bacteria. Many of these natural plant defense chemicals you may already be familiar with. Oleocanthal from olive oil, resveratrol from red wine grapes, and even curcumin from turmeric. But in fact, there are thousands of these chemicals that we regularly consume with a vegetable-rich diet, and we're just beginning to understand the impact they have on us. Most of them have yet to be named. Among these chemicals are polyphenols, a large family of plant-based nutrients that are well known to benefit our health. Recent research has highlighted polyphenols as being broadly anti-inflammatory, protecting us against age-related inflammation and chronic diseases such as cancer, heart disease, and dementia. Although the exact mechanisms of action behind polyphenol consumption have been somewhat elusive, hormesis has surfaced as one possible explanation. Here are a few of the common polyphenols divided by category. Polyphenol food sources. Catechins, found in green and white tea, grapes, cocoa, and berries. Flavonones, found in oranges, grapefruits, and lemons. Flavanols, found in cocoa, green vegetables, onions, and berries. Anthocyanins, found in berries, red grapes, and red onions. Resveratrol, found in red wine, grape skins, pistachios, and peanuts. Curcumin, found in turmeric. And oleocanthal, found in extra virgin olive oil. These compounds exert their benefit on us in part by creating a small amount of stress at the cellular level. When we consume polyphenols, our cells respond defensively by flipping the switch on gene activity that boosts antioxidant production. In fact, the antioxidants stimulated by polyphenols outshine the free radical scavenging effects of more commonly known antioxidants like vitamins E and C. Those antioxidants work one-to-one, meaning one molecule of vitamin C disarms one free radical. But the antioxidants that polyphenols lead our bodies to create, such as the free radical-fighting warrior glutathione, can disarm countless free radicals. In this way, eating polyphenol-rich foods is like giving our cells a workout, challenging them to detoxify, adapt, and grow more resilient to stress. You can further support the production of glutathione, dubbed the mother of all antioxidants, by consuming more sulfur-rich foods, including broccoli, garlic, onions, leeks, eggs, spinach, kale, grass-fed beef, fish, and nuts. Each polyphenol may have its own unique benefit, but science has revealed some to be particularly beneficial. Oleocanthal in extra virgin olive oil, for example, has been shown to help the brain clear itself of plaque, stoking the self-cleaning process of autophagy, described earlier. Another phenolic compound called apigenin, abundant in parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, has been found to promote neurogenesis and strengthen synaptic connections. Perhaps Simon and Garfunkel were inspired by apigenin when they wrote their hit song. Here are some other well-known polyphenols and their proposed benefits. Resveratrol, found in red wine, dark chocolate, and pistachios. Improves brain glucose metabolism and cognitive function. Quercetin, found in onions. Strengthens gut barrier integrity and reduces permeability. Anthocyanins, found in blueberries. Reduces cognitive aging and Alzheimer's risk. Fisetin, found in strawberries and cucumbers, reduces brain inflammation and protects against cognitive decline. One more reason to go organic. It is well established that by opting for organic produce, you are avoiding exposure to synthetic herbicides and pesticides that can disrupt neurotransmitter function and increase your risk for certain neurodegenerative diseases. Here's another reason to look for the organic label. The use of synthetic pesticides and herbicides on produce can dramatically handicap the plant's creation of their own defense mechanisms, the very polyphenols we want. Many studies that compare vitamin content of conventionally grown produce with that of organically grown produce overlook this point. The most health-promoting nutrients in these plants are not always vitamins, but the natural defense compounds that, when consumed, stoke genetic restoration pathways in us. Another well-known class of plant-based defense chemicals are glucosinolates, Cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, cabbage, and kale are rich in these compounds, with young broccoli sprouts taking the crown for the top known source, containing 20 to 100 times the amount of that of full-grown broccoli heads. When any of these plants are chewed, these compounds combine with an enzyme also in the plant that creates a new compound in your mouth, sulforaphane. Thank Darwin you're not an insect, as sulforaphane would be toxic to you if you were. In humans, however, sulforaphane